Good morning. I'd like to thank Aditi for organizing a session on oligotrophic ecosystems, and also thank you for the invitation to speak. I think that oligotrophic ecosystems are particularly fascinating because it gives us the opportunity to see the full power of microorganisms, because they really have colonized every single niche that we've tried to explore on this planet, and we've yet to find them, which I think we will on other planets. Today I've picked the topic of the arid soil microbiome. I'm from Tucson, and welcome to the Southwest. It's probably a novel ecosystem for many people here. I want to begin by recognizing all of my co-authors. There's a lot of people contributing to this work. Jay Quaid is a geologist I work with at the U of A. Audrey Copeland, Will, and Katie are the students and postdocs that have helped with the field work and all the processing. Greg Caparezzo at NAU has been important in the bioinformatics, along with Cesar Cardona at University of Chicago. Raina Mayer and Karen Josephson at U of A, and Jack Gilbert and Rob Knight through the Earth Microbiome have contributed to this work. I want to begin to say that one third of the terrestrial biomes on Earth are deserts. And I think that's a surprising factor for many people. The other piece of data is that these deserts store 27% of global organic carbon. And as we look at climate change, these arid regions are projected to become drier and hotter. And so we may see regime shifts from semi-arid to arid to hyper-arid. And if you're not from a desert region, what that means to those of us who live here is we may go from vegetated to unvegetated. And that has all kinds of repercussions. We have huge dust storms here in Tucson that cause huge traffic accidents on I-10. And that's just the sort of the applied significance. But if you think of issues like stored organic carbon, when you're losing vegetation, that may be important to the future of this planet. Since we're talking about oligotrophy, if we use soil organic carbon as a proxy for nutrition, you could say that temperate soils have between 1 and 6 or whatever percent organic carbon. The Chihuahuan Desert in New Mexico, which is one of the wetter deserts in the Southwest, has organic carbon levels ranging from 0.1 to 0.4%, or 0.5, excuse me, depending on whether you're looking at the open spaces or the fertility islands. And my research focuses on the Atacama Desert in northern Chile, and that is one of the driest deserts on Earth. So we are progressing to a level of organic carbon that's one order of magnitude even lower than the Chihuahuan Desert. And my specific objectives in this talk are first to utilize the Atacama Desert to really ask the question, is the arid soil microbiome unique as compared to other global soil microbial communities? And then to look at what are the major geochemical and environmental factors that influence the diversity within that microbiome. Because I contend that if we're going to understand the stability of arid ecosystems as aridity increases, we need to understand the role of that microbiome in sustaining those arid ecosystems. So what makes the Atacama Desert so dry? Just as a brief introduction, the Pacific Ocean has a very cold current running north along the western coast of Chile, and that keeps the evaporation minimal. In addition, there's right here, this little thing that juts out is the city of Antofagasta, and this is the driest portion of the Atacama right here, and it from here going up to the border with Peru is the focal area of where I'm doing my research. And all along this area, you have a very steep escarpment, about 1,000 meters tall along the coast, and so it traps whatever moisture comes off the ocean into a fog region along the coast. In addition, any of the water that may come with the trade winds from the Atlantic Ocean rains out on the eastern slopes of the Andes. And the Andes basically form the border between Argentina, Bolivia, and Chile to the west. So you get very little rainfall coming into the desert with those monsoon rains. And the only rains you really get potentially in the central Atacama are southern storms that very rarely make it that far north in Chile. So we have two sample transects that we have studied over the last 10 or 12 years. And they range in precipitation from zero, believe it or not, millimeters. They get a rainfall event in the central Atacama maybe once every 10 to 50 years. And then up into the Andes where we get about 120 millimeters per year. And these transects are about, the northern one is called the Bacadano one, the southern one is Yungay, and they are about 250 to 300 kilometers long. At each of our sample sites, we look at a range of soil parameters. We look at pH, electrical conductivity as a measure of salinity in the soil, percent plant cover, soil nitrates, soil sulfates. We have data loggers buried at a depth of 20 centimeters, and they have been recording data for soil relative humidity and soil temperature over the last over a 3-year period. And then we look at microbial community composition using 16S rRNA gene amplicons. This gives you just a basic range of the conditions that we see across all our transects. The pH is neutral to alkaline. Salinity ranges from 0.02 to almost 3 decisiemens per meter. Soil organic carbon is from 0.02% up to 1.6%. Plant cover, nothing, up to 9%. Average soil relative humidity is 17% averaged over this 3-year period in the driest regions, up to 100% in the wetter regions. And then our temperatures are between 9 and 24 degrees centigrade. Sulfates and nitrates, we looked at those, at the accumulation of those salts in the shallow regions of the profile, because they're a really good indication of long-term hyperaridity. Nitrates accumulate in the Atacama Desert. That was a major source of fertilizer before we had synthetic chemical nitrogen fertilizers. And they only accumulate when there's virtually no rainfall because there's such a soluble salt. And so by looking at these salt profiles, I know you can't read that. All I want you to take home is to see that there are salts in some places and there aren't salts in other places. That's the take home of this graph. And we use that data to categorize our sites into 3 groups. If there are significant accumulations of nitrate salts, we also look at halites, at gypsum, we can categorize some of our sites as hyperarid. On the other extreme, if we see vegetation there at the times when we're sampling, those are categorized as arid. And then that transition zone in the middle, which is really the area that I'm most interested in, is why do you go from an ecosystem that can sustain vegetation to one that can't? So the margin is defined as no salt accumulation and no plants present. So then we're going to look at how do these factors that we've looked at affect the arid soil microbiome. So just looking at richness and diversity, the top graph is phylogenetic diversity, a measure of richness. The x-axis here is average soil relative humidity from 0 to 100%. And you can see we have a linear relationship with increasing aridity with a Spearman's R value of 0.75. That's a very strong correlation. And the same with diversity. And for those who aren't familiar with the Shannon Diversity Index, it's a measure of the evenness of the population. So if you have 10 OTUs, is the abundance of the 10 evenly distributed, or do you have a high abundance of 1? So what we want is a more even distribution. And as you can see, the diversity is also very strongly correlated with increasing aridity. Next, I want to look at the phylogenetic composition, and I'll start by looking at this figure here. The orange dots in this principal coordinate analysis are our Atacama sites, samples, microbial composition plots. And we superimposed our data from a paper from Noah Fier that Greg Caparezzo published with him in 2012 in PNAS, where he looked at global soil microbiomes. And the first thing I want you to see is these green dots. I'm not as good with the cursor. See if I can get it. All right, I'm not going to use it. Sorry, I'm not going to use the cursor. Down there in the bottom left, the green dots, those are global non-desert soils. And they include tropical rainforest, tundra, temperate forest, temperate grasslands. And you can see that they're very distinct from the desert soils. The blue dots are the McMurdo Dry Valleys of Antarctica, and the purple and mustard are deserts in the southwest, the Mojave Desert and the Chihuahuan Desert. So what you can see here, first of all, is that the arid soil microbiome is very distinct from all other global soils in terms of its microbial composition. And second, that we have this really broad diversity of different microbial composition within the Atacama Desert. So the next question is why? What are the drivers? And we looked at a range of different things. Here I'm presenting 4 of them. In the top right corner, average soil relative humidity. The lighter circles represent lower values of humidity, and as the circles get darker, it's higher values of that parameter. You can see the correlation is 0.625. If we look at temperature, basically 0.4. Soil salinity is 0.5. And this one is very interesting. pH is 1.18. For anyone who's followed the discussion of what drives phylogenetic variance within global soils, it's generally agreed that pH is a determining factor for variance in microbial composition. And I think this is very important that we understand that the arid soil microbial communities march to a different drummer. And this is partially because we don't have acidic soils, which are very important in terms of determining composition. But I would also argue that maybe the microbes of deserts are very tolerant to alkaline pHs in a way that's maybe distinct from non-desert microbial communities. That's not proved, that's just a hypothesis at this point. The next thing we looked at is network analysis. And for those of you who have never seen one of these crazy plots, what they mean is that every single node or dot in these topologies is an OTU. And OTUs are connected by a line or an edge if their relative abundance correlates at a level of 0.81 or higher. So if two organisms, as you move between different scenarios, have the same relative abundance as you change conditions, then they're going to have a line between them. In this graph, the yellow dots represent high levels of average soil relative humidity, and as they get darker, we move down to lower. And one of the first things you can see is that the network looks kind of denser where the humidity is higher, and then as you get down to the darker levels, we have these strange sort of protrusions that are sort of isolated assemblages. And the other thing to note is the size of the dot is the degree value, and what degree value means is how many other organisms are correlated with that particular taxon. So if you have a whole bunch of correlations, it's going to be a larger degree value. And if we look at the statistics, the node degree is very strongly correlated with average soil relative humidity. And betweenness is another network statistic, which is how many times does a taxon connect to other taxa, so act as a bridge. And that is also strongly correlated. And what we say this indicates is that the communities, as they dry out, are becoming much less connected, much less, there are many fewer co-occurrences. And based on this observation, we then wanted to ask, okay, if we break them up into their into those three aridity classes, what will these networks look like? So we did subnetwork analysis, and here's the arid one. It looks fairly much the same. It's still a fairly well-connected network. When we go to the margin, all of a sudden things start to sort of disintegrate, and you have clusters with fairly large node values, but they're connected by these kind of long protrusions. And when we go into the hyper-arid region, those clusters just kind of disintegrate into different separate clusters. Now, I want to say network analysis in the field of microbial ecology is relatively new. 99% of these correlations are positive in this scenario, and there's a lot of theories out there. All we know for sure is it means that they co-occur, but that could mean they share similar resources. It could mean that they actually are cross-feeding and they depend on each other for survival, or it could mean that they have symbiotic relationships on even a stronger level. So the question that we want to ask moving forwards is, do these communities lose resilience as they start to, you could say, disintegrate, you could say, lose connectivity? So we don't really understand the significance of this pattern, but as you can see, the pattern is huge. And it would seem to imply that the communities are the organisms are having to survive in a much more isolated scenario. So then the last thing I wanted to look at is, as we've looked at this loss of diversity associated with aridity, drastic change in phylogenetic composition and a sort of a disintegration of the integrated community, what does that mean in terms of the major phyla that we know to be important functional components of an ecosystem? And what this is, I know you can't read all the small print, which is the take-home message here is at the very top you've got the moisture gradient with 100% on the far right. It's a heat map, so within each phylum, dark red is higher relative abundance. On the bottom, the yellow squares are hyper-arid. The green squares on the right are arid. As you move towards hyper-arid, the community really simplifies. You lose abundance of some major phyla. And if we... the ones at the top, I'm sorry, are all strongly correlated with average soil relative humidity. These three groups on the bottom, which are Chlorophyllexi, Bacteroidetes, and Firmicutes, and I'm interested in the last talk on Bacteroidetes, I'll have to talk to you more, they're not correlated with average soil relative humidity, and I think that's kind of interesting to look at. If we look at several cross-biome studies, global studies, have identified these five phylum as being the dominant phylum across the board in microbial communities. And if we look at these five, Acidobacteria, Proteobacteria, Verrucomicrobia, Actinobacteria, and Bacteroidetes, three of them are extremely strongly correlated with average soil relative humidity, 0.84 to 0.93 over here on the right column. And virtually we're losing them as we really dry out. And there's some important players in these phyla. We haven't gone so far as to tease out who in fact is being lost. Actinobacteria, fascinating, becomes highly dominant. And that's a very diverse phyla. And then finally, Bacteroidetes is not affected. So if we ask, you know, who are the dominant players in a hyperarid ecosystem, here we are, actinobacteria, 78%, give or take 10% of the community, followed by proteobacteria, chloroflexi, and gematomonadetes. Very different distribution from what you see on the left. And so the question is, I mean, chloroflexi are also a very diverse phylum with very diverse metabolic potential. Can this group of organisms provide the ecosystem services that we are accustomed to providing through soil to plants, to allow plants to survive? So in summary, the diversity of arid soils decreases significantly with increasing aridity. Phylogenetic composition of desert soils is distinct from non-desert soils, and the Atacama shows us that phylogenetic diversity doesn't cluster in one single type, but we have this huge diversity, which we have found to be most strongly controlled by, we measured relative average soil relative humidity, but basically aridity. And the relative abundance of three phyla that are typically dominant in soil communities decreased significantly with increasing aridity. So with that, I'd like to recognize our funding sources, the NIEHS through the Superfund program, NSF, the Lewis and Clark Fund for Exploration and Field Research in Astrobiology, and the Earth Microbiome Project. Thank you.
So I was curious with the hyperarid networks, have you coded those or looked at those by site? In other words, are your different clusters basically different sites?
Yeah, I was hoping that was going to happen because I didn't have enough time to really delve into the hyperarid. But one of the fascinating things about the hyperarid is that each geographic site is heavily dominated by a single OTU, I mean 30%, and they're different. So I move from this valley, and it's a different one, but they don't correspond. I was hoping they would correspond to each of those clusters, because then I thought, wow, now we can do something cool. But I tracked one chloroflexi that is an unknown thing, and it was in only 4 of the 7 clusters, and it was present in only 4 of the 5 geographic locations within my hyperarid area. And this hyperarid area spans 100 kilometers. So that's what that's where I want to go from here with this research, is I'd like to tease apart these networks, and I'd like to understand what is the meaning of these clusters. Why are these guys together? And can I understand, because most of the organisms, except for the Rubrobacter, which is a well-known UV-tolerant organism, actinobacteria, most of the chloroflexi, gematomonadetes, and actinos, we don't really know what they're doing and how they're surviving. I have some collaborators in Chile that are trying to do some enrichment cultures to figure out who the primary producers are. And there's some cool data they've come up with doing just qPCR on archaea and bacteria. And when you wet these up with no carbon source, you get a response. So these guys are alive. But we would love to understand who they are, what they're doing. And I think this network stuff could really give us a clue to starting to see who's interacting with each other. So yes, that's the next step.
So just trying to think in practical terms, as climate's changing, maybe we are going to get some areas that go from arid to hyperarid, et cetera, but then what if we start to, so we have this reduced number of bacteria, are they, and your question, are they, basically, I think you asked this, is are they functioning, are they able to carry out the functions that we need them to do? What if we then wet up the soil? Will those groups come back?
So I call that, my question is, what is the phylogenetic seed bank? And that is actually the paper I just submitted, that's the final question in the paper. What is the phylogenetic seed bank? Because I think all of us who do ITAG analysis or high throughput sequencing know that we don't see everything. We see some percentage. And I think through quantitative PCR of individual taxa, I could actually try to address that question. And what I would like to do is wetting experiments where I try to track. I have another set of data where I've tracked known nitrogen cycling organisms, and they also correlate. Either they're non-existent, you know, things like Bradyrhizobia, Nitrosophera, they're either non-existent or they track with aridity. So what would happen? Because this is a big question in degraded land research. You know, do we need to reseed with microorganisms? Or will, if we get through a dry period, a mega drought like we're having in the Southwest, and it starts to rain again, will the microbes kick back in and come back up in abundance? And yes, so that's I don't have an answer to that, but that I think is a really important question in terms of applied and research of and restoration of degraded lands, which is actually what my, you know, one of my big interests.
Maybe we'll speak after the session. Thank you.